Good morning. This is AM. I'm Tony Eastley. Media tycoon Rupert Murdoch has agreed to a very public grilling next week by the British Parliament over his company's role in the telephone hacking scandal. Mr. Murdoch, his son James, and News International's Rebecca Brooks will face a volley of questions as to what they knew and when. Their RSVP to the UK Parliament came as another senior executive of News of the World was arrested. Europe correspondent Rachel Brown reports.
Once it was normal practice for politicians to come to his door, now they're making their own demands. They want Rupert Murdoch to front up for questioning at Westminster. A cartoon in the Guardian newspaper shows Rupert Murdoch holding a gold-embossed invitation to, quote, an ass-kicking party at Westminster on the occasion of his fall from grace.
Today at 5, Rupert Murdoch will submit to questioning by MPs over the hacking.
The media tycoon initially declined the invitation, and his son James Murdoch said he was only free for 2 days in August. But after an official legal summons, they've had a change of heart. Martin Moore founded Hacked Off, the campaign for a full inquiry into phone hacking.
It will certainly be dramatic. I think it'll be probably remarkable theatre amongst everything else. But I hope that in amongst the theatre that actually we do start to get some answers to the questions that most people will be asking.
The Culture Committee Chairman, John Whittingdale, who'll lead the hearing, has the challenge of ensuring it's neither ineffectual theatre nor, at the other end of the spectrum, a public hanging.
Obviously, the judicial inquiry is going to be a much more intensive and long-lasting examination of all the facts behind this. But that won't even start, I think, for some time. So this will be the first chance on Tuesday for Rupert Murdoch, James Murdoch and Rebecca Brooks to account for what has been going on within their newspapers.
Already there's scepticism about how candid the Murdochs will be and whether they'll use the current criminal investigation as a way to deflect the tough questions. Lawyer Mark Lewis.
There is a fear that this is going to be the three monkeys who hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil. So what comes out, I'm not optimistic about, but it's a step that's worth taking. Questions will have to be asked of them, and it might be the silences that will be the embarrassing point.
John Whittingdale says they have a lot of explaining to do.
James Murdoch has already said that he now knows that my committee were misled when we took evidence on this matter 2 years ago. We want to know precisely how we were misled and when he discovered it and what he has done about it.
Also overnight came the ninth arrest in the investigation, Neil Wallace, the former executive editor of the News of the World. It's emerged his PR company was engaged by the Metropolitan Police as an advisor.
Not only that, but the former Director of Public Prosecutions, who had oversight of these matters, is now the counsel to News International.
Keith Vaz from the Home Affairs Select Committee says he's gobsmacked. Scotland Yard says it went through the proper tender process, but it's yet another cosy arrangement that'll raise eyebrows. This is Rachel Brown in London reporting for AM.
There's unease in the US over the role of the Murdoch media there. The FBI says it will investigate whether the phone hacking firestorm in Britain has reached American shores. US lawmakers have been calling for days for formal probes into whether the phone records of September 11 victims were hacked. With more on the story, we're joined by North America correspondent Craig McMurtry. Craig, good morning. News Corporation would like to think, I suppose, that the hacking scandal is contained in the UK. What sparked the interest in the US?
Well, it was the 9/11 mentioned, Tony. It seems to have come from a Daily Mail report suggesting that a New York police officer may have been approached by News Corporation employees and asked to access the voicemails of 9/11 victims and their families. And 9/11 is an extremely sensitive issue. It's a hot button issue here, and that has certainly annoyed many politicians here in Washington.
Who are the people wanting this investigation, Craig?
Well, two senior Democrats, Barbara Boxer, Jay Rockefeller, also a Republican congressman, Peter King, very senior. He's actually written a letter and released it to the director of the FBI saying, quote, it's revolting to imagine that members of the media would seek to compromise the integrity of a public official for financial gain, describing it as yellow journalism. Someone else, an Iowa Democrat, Bruce Braley, has also got involved calling for an investigation, and he's denying that it's any sort of fishing expedition or that their concerns are anything other than legitimate.
We do know that there are concerns about the possibility that voicemails from 9/11 victims have been improperly obtained, and because we don't really know the identity of those victims and where they resided, there's a possibility that U.S. citizens could have improperly had their voicemails or electronic communications improperly accessed by News Corp or someone acting on their behalf. And because of the growing alarm about that issue, I have joined my House colleagues in calling for further investigation to make sure that there's been no violation of U.S. law under statutes like the Federal Corrupt Action Practices Act.
U.S. lawmaker Bruce Braley speaking there. Craig McMurtry, what exposure do American politicians generally have to the Murdoch media empire?
Oh, the media empire here is very powerful. There is, of course, the Fox News Channel, very influential, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Post, and, of course, movies and various other interests. I should add, speaking about the Wall Street Journal, that Rupert Murdoch has given an interview to the Wall Street Journal about the scandal, where he's saying that he will establish an independent committee to investigate the charges. But he's also defending how the crisis has been handled, saying that it's been handled extremely well in every way possible, talking about just a few minor mistakes. And on the damage, he's saying to the Wall Street Journal that it's nothing that won't be recovered. He says, we have a reputation of great good works in this country, and asked if he was annoyed by the bad headlines in recent days. He says he's just getting annoyed, but he'll get over it and that he's tired.
Craig McMurtry, our correspondent in North America. The federal opposition says it's not convinced that there's a need for an inquiry into Australia's media, its ownership and its behaviour. The Greens leader Bob Brown has proposed a wide-ranging inquiry in the wake of the News International scandal, and the Prime Minister says she's willing to consider it. But the opposition's communications spokesman Malcolm Turnbull says while UK events have been shocking, there's no evidence of improper conduct in Australian media. Mr Turnbull is speaking here to Naomi Woodley in Canberra.
We're not convinced that there's a need for a new inquiry into media ownership. The issue's been dealt with fairly recently, only about 5 years ago. And I have to say that the competition in the media is increasing very, very rapidly. The proliferation of internet news outlets and, of course, the ready availability of foreign news sources in Australia means that the media scene in Australia is more competitive than ever.
So you don't believe that the News International scandal in the UK has tarnished at least the perception of the media here?
Well, look, I think you're talking about two very different things. The scandal in the United Kingdom over phone hacking is truly shocking, absolutely deplorable. But that scandal, however, is really speaks to a failure of management at the News of the World and perhaps another news limited newspaper there, and also what appears to be the failure of the police to thoroughly investigate it.
But Bob Brown's talking about something a bit wider than just ownership. He's saying perhaps there needs to be a fit and proper test for media ownership. He's indicating he'd like to look at the broader question of media ethics. Would that be timely?
There have always been rules of fitness, propriety or related concepts applying to broadcast media, and that's because it's radio and television, but that's because they are licensed properties. Now, as far as newspapers are concerned, there's never been any requirement for people to have a license to operate a newspaper, and I think it would be appalling if we were to get to that point. I mean, why in a free society should there be a restriction on somebody's right to publish a newspaper? Of course they've got to comply with the law, but to say that you need to have a government license to open a newspaper, I'm amazed that that's being seriously contemplated.
You faced some of that personal scrutiny this week on the carbon tax when you pointed out that your leader, Tony Abbott, had had several different policy positions on climate change and that you hadn't been shown consistent loyalty as leader. Do you regret saying that?
I don't really want to go over that ground again. I mean, there's a history to all of these things. You know, everybody knows what the facts are. There's no need for me to repeat them today.
But in the current climate, where every statement seems to be examined even more forensically than the last, was it helpful for you to say that or for the question to be asked?
I don't think statements are being examined forensically at all. I think they are being twisted, and people look to see anything I say on that issue is going to someone, notably the media, will endeavour to turn that into an attack on Tony Abbott. Now, I have not attacked Tony Abbott. I've said that the principle is that members of the shadow cabinet come into the shadow cabinet generally with a range of personal opinions on particular issues. And they then come to a common position and then they vote in accordance with that commonly agreed on position, and that is the principle of cabinet responsibility. Now, if explaining that is regarded as an attack on somebody, then we really have reached a genuinely bizarre state of affairs in terms of political reporting.
The opposition's communications spokesman, Malcolm Turnbull, speaking to Naomi Woodley. The opposition leader, Tony Abbott, has been accused at a public forum in Brisbane of scaremongering over how the carbon tax will affect the coal industry. In the state where coal is both a rich source of jobs and royalties, the opposition leader was asked to specify how many jobs would be lost. Matt Wordsworth reports the majority of people at the forum appeared to side with the opposition leader.
It was a winter's night, but Tony Abbott shed his jacket to mingle with the 100-strong audience at Customs House. When he took the microphone, the gloves were off too.
There is no country on earth which is trying to introduce an economy-wide carbon tax or emissions trading scheme.
An audience member best summed up the anger towards the Prime Minister's carbon tax backflip.
To me, she's not showing any ethics or character. If I lied to get a job, I'd get sacked.
But Mr Abbott felt some heat north of the border from a woman whose son works in the mining industry.
Why do you persist with the scaremongering by insisting that with the introduction of a price on carbon, the coal industry faces certain demise?
Because if coal goes from 80% of power generation to 10% of power generation, as the government's own documents state, that's obviously got pretty big implications for the coal industry.
It's not going to shut down.
Well, it's going to go from 80% of power to 10% of power on the government's own documents. I think we're going to have to agree to disagree on this one, Vicky.
But more than one interrogator was hoping for a future with more renewable energy.
Would your government commit to research and development, greater research and development in this area?
I have no wish to cut research and development in this area.
The opposition leader says the current debate boils down to whether his $3.2 billion direct action package is more effective.
I think we can achieve a 5% emissions reduction target without this big new impost on our economy. I think we can spend from savings in the budget enough money on things like more trees on suitable land, getting more carbon into soil, using technology smarter. I think we can do enough of that to achieve that outcome.
Julia Gillard says it won't be as efficient if it doesn't use the market.
He's either left in an endless world of picking winners, where Canberra bureaucrats pick which polluters to subsidise, even as polluters next door open up. So you work with one business, give them some money, they reduce their pollution, but there's no economy-wide cap. A business next door can just open up the next day with more pollution. And so when you model all of that through, we believe the costs will be $720 per year per family, which is a far greater cost for our economy than anything we are asking people to do.
But the two leaders have something in common. After each of their forums, they had swung people to their point of view. But to borrow a phrase from an independent, in the end, there can be only one.
Matt Wordsworth reporting. You're listening to AM Around Australia on ABC Radio National, where it's 24 minutes past seven. The United Nations has delivered a grim report showing civilian casualties in Afghanistan are worse than ever. Almost 1,500 civilians were killed in the first 6 months of this year, a 15% increase on the same time last year. The civilian casualty report was released shortly before a suicide bomber blew himself up at a memorial service for the assassinated brother of President Hamid Karzai. Afghanistan correspondent Sally Sara reports from Kabul.
The latest figures confirm that more Afghan civilians have been killed than in any other year of the war. 1,462 died in the first half of this year. More than 80% were killed by insurgents. UN Special Representative in Afghanistan, Staffan de Mistura, has condemned the violence and called on all sides to respect the lives of civilians.
These are not just figures. These are names. These are people. These are men, women, elder people, children. These are Afghan people.
The report shows that homemade bombs, known as improvised explosive devices or IEDs, are the most devastating weapon in the conflict. Many of the IEDs are pressure plates set to trigger explosives. The plates are buried just below the surface. The director of the UN Human Rights Unit in Afghanistan, Georgette Gagnon, says the pressure plate IEDs are deadly.
This tactic of using these IEDs is a violation of the laws of war and humanitarian principles.
Afghanistan's Independent Human Rights Commission says the real civilian casualty toll is much higher than the numbers published by the United Nations. Commissioner Nadia Nadiri says the injured, the bereaved and traumatised are not counted.
These numbers are not demonstrating the real suffering that the population are going through. It's not just the body count.
The United Nations report says Afghan and coalition forces were responsible for 18% of the civilian casualties in the first half of this year. But Staffan de Mistura says the Taliban must still take responsibility for the majority of deaths.
We have been in touch with the Taliban about the issue of civilian casualties, and we are in touch with them.
But it's not just the Taliban accused of taking lives. President Hamid Karzai has ordered an inquiry into claims that six civilians were killed in a NATO raid in the eastern province of Khost. The local provincial council has gone on strike to express its outrage at the deaths. It's been a confronting week for President Karzai. Yesterday, a suicide bomber blew himself up at a memorial service for the president's brother, who was assassinated on Tuesday. It was one violent act layered on another. It showed the insurgents are still able to get through security barriers and target some of the highest profile political and tribal figures in the country. This is Sally Sara in Kabul for AM.
In the United States, the prospects of politicians reaching a deal to raise the debt ceiling have taken a hit. Even China is now warning the US to avoid a default on its loans, but talks led by the US President Barack Obama have degenerated into a slanging match after an acrimonious two-hour negotiating session. North America correspondent Jane Cowan reports.
The impasse on the debt talks has exasperation spilling out all over Washington. On the Senate floor,
I'm very disappointed in all of us.
On the steps of Capitol Hill,
all we ask of the president is to lead.
And in the White House, the president said to have stalked out of the latest debt talks, which both sides acknowledged were the most heated yet. Barack Obama's quoted as saying, "This may bring my presidency down, but I'll not yield on this." Democrats like Nancy Pelosi, though, say that account is overblown. But they acknowledge the president did say enough is enough.
I just don't understand what the problem is if the president of the United States, who's had a meeting for over 2 hours, stands up and says, "See you tomorrow." That's how meetings with presidents end.
So far, the president has successfully positioned himself as the one ready to cut a deal, and the Republicans are looking increasingly like the bad guys, the mainstream media at least, focusing on their intransigence. High-profile presidential candidates like Sarah Palin aren't helping that image.
Now is not the time to retreat, it's right. The time to reload.
One commentator described the contradictions pervading Republican arguments on the debt ceiling as being as plentiful as snowflakes in a blizzard. Even conservatives are beginning to acknowledge their approach could backfire on them politically. Major Garrett is a congressional correspondent for the National Journal.
The most important takeaway is these negotiations are producing nothing except hostility. And those who are watching it on the outside, bond rating agencies, people who trade in bonds as collateral instruments, after weeks and weeks of saying everything's going to be fine, are now beginning to get to the edge of panic.
America's largest creditor, China, holding $1 trillion of American debt, has urged the US to safeguard the interests of its investors. And a Chinese ratings agency echoed Moody's warning that America could lose its AAA credit rating by putting US sovereign debt on a downgrade watch. Amid the acrimony, there are reports, downplayed by the White House, that Barack Obama has floated the possibility of moving negotiations to Camp David, the presidential retreat in the mountains of Maryland, more famous for brokering peace deals of the international kind. This is Jane Cowan in Washington for AM.
To the financial markets, and stocks on Wall Street closed at their lowest level this month on word that a third round of stimulus talks had failed. The Dow Jones closing down 54 points, the Nasdaq down 34. The dollar buying 107.2 US cents, 84.8 Japanese yen, 75.8 euro cents. I'm Tony Eastley. Thanks for your company. That's AM for today.